Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Black Lives Matter protesters held rallies this past weekend in Fresno and Bakersfield. We'll hear from the organizer of one of those protests and get perspectives from a man who wants to lead the Valley's largest city, current Fresno County Supervisor and Fresno mayoral candidate Henry Perea. We'll also talk about the city's water scare that has some Northeast residents concerned about rusty, cloudy water caused by deteriorating pipes. The pipes are inside the homes, but some are pointing the finger at City Hall, saying the city should have done more to prevent the corrosion in the first place. It's become the latest political issue in the mayor's race, and we'll hear what Perea says he would do about it. Plus, stay with us. You won't want to miss our last segment today as author and historian Michael J. Semus joins us. He's giving a talk tonight about historical image of the Valley, and he'll take us on a tour from Morro Rock in the Sierra to Morro Rock on the coast as it would have looked like 100 years ago. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the world of healthcare. Have you ever called your doctor or hospital seeking an appointment and been told the wait will be weeks or maybe months? You have been affected by the Central Valley's doctor shortage. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports that one group is pushing a potential solution, locally sourced doctors from a proposed new medical school.
Being in a waiting room at a doctor's office is not the most pleasant place to be, but waiting to get into that waiting room can be even worse. That is what healthcare experts call a doctor shortage, and in the Valley, it's bad. The Valley has about half the doctors per 100,000 people compared to places like the Bay Area. And compared to the state average, the San Joaquin Valley has about 50% fewer doctors. And when you dig into high-demand specialists, the picture can be even bleaker. The answer, according to people in both the private and public sector, is a medical school dedicated to the Central Valley.
Most of the medical literature I've ever read always suggests medical school and residencies are how you can retain and keep physicians locally.
Newly minted Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula, a physician who represents the 31st District covering a big chunk of the Central Valley, has made bringing a medical school to the Valley a main promise. Arambula says establishing a medical school would keep students in the Valley throughout their education, making it more likely they stay long term.
Now the question is how and how soon and what does it look like? And there are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to. At the end of the day, to be as forthcoming as I can, I don't care how this cat gets skinned. I care that it gets done.
Arambula thinks an ideal situation would be establishing the school at UC Merced. However, he says he's had meetings with two private groups, including the Assemi family, about building a private medical school. The Assemis founded the California Health Sciences University, which is a private pharmacy school in Clovis. The family is also a donor to Valley Public Radio. Provost Wendy Duncan says the vision is to slowly add additional programs over the next 15 years until the school can offer a range of education up to a physician's residency.
Oh my goodness, yes, there's huge demand. Actually, whenever we talk about the need for particular kinds of healthcare providers, people's eyes light up because they know that there's a huge need. You know, the wait times for primary care are getting to be really ridiculously long.
No matter if it's private or public, medical schools are expensive, costing $100 million or more. But the evidence of people staying in the area after they do their residency is conflicting. Industry research says in California, which is a popular destination for students and doctors, upwards of 75% of students stay in the state after they do their residency. However, for the residency program at UCSF Fresno, only about 30% of those students stay and work in the Central Valley. So why not cut out the middleman and just bring in established doctors?
It's pretty difficult, actually, to convince physicians to come to Fresno.
Jolie Lamone is the chief of pediatrics with Valley Children's Hospital. She says their focus is on recruiting doctors to the Central Valley, but that has its own challenges, since doctors can go just about anywhere in the country.
You know, it's Central California. It's not right at the beach. It's not right in the mountains. we do have a large underserved population, and maybe that's not attractive to people. But I think it's just general outside people out of the state have a perception of California, and this is not what it is.
Lamone is skeptical that establishing a medical school would result in a material increase in the number of doctors working here, saying it's more about finding doctors who want to live a Valley lifestyle. Not to mention, building a medical school, training doctors, and convincing them to stay here will take years. The Valley has a doctor shortage right now, especially when the population is growing and many newly insured people are seeking out all kinds of care. While strongly supporting the idea of a medical school, John Kapitman with the Central Valley Health Policy Institute says it can't be the only step taken to improve access to health care, pointing to other options like licensed practical nurses, allowing pharmacists to have limited prescribing ability, and establishing patient-centered medical homes.
You know, so that's another example of a framework, the intent of which is to sort of broaden the healthcare workforce, so it's not just doctors and nurses.
Freeing up pharmacists to do more is an idea that's getting kicked around Sacramento, and one that is supported by the local private pharmacy school. Whether it's building a new medical school, recruiting existing docs to the Valley, or broadening who can provide what healthcare, the problems with access are unlikely to vanish anytime soon. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Some Fresno residents have a water problem. It's not a lack of water, but rather what it looks like, tastes like, and what it contains as it comes out of their taps. Dozens of Northeast Fresno residents have been complaining of rusty, yellow water, and in some cases, tests have detected levels of lead in their homes. The city says the problem is inside the homes and that the water they're supplying residents at the meter is safe. The exact cause in every case is unknown, but it's believed that deteriorating galvanized pipes on private property are the common denominator. But some believe the problem is connected to the city's switch a decade ago from relatively hard, calcium-rich groundwater to relatively soft surface water from the Northeast Surface Water Treatment Plant. Until reports recently surfaced in January, the city had not been adding an anti-corrosion treatment to the water. One of the biggest critics has been mayoral candidate Henry Perea. Last week, he held a news conference to say the city isn't doing enough to address the issue. Thus far, the city has sent out nearly 30,000 notices to residents alerting them to the problem and letting them know they can get their water tested. A week ago on this very program, Perea's opponent in the November election, Councilmember Lee Brand, who represents Northeast Fresno, where the water problem exists, called Perea's weighing into the issue political opportunism. This week, we hear what Perea has to say. I had a chance to speak with him yesterday about the water issue and about the current controversy over law enforcement abuses of power and the Black Lives Matter movement. Supervisor Perea, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
This issue of water quality and, in some cases, lead in the water in some Fresno homes is really blowing up right now. What do you think the city should have done differently on the response to this issue?
Well, I mean, I think you can go back in time, and this is becoming easier to dissect now in terms of what happened. And what we know is that there was a surface water treatment plant that went online in Northeast Fresno in 2004. And like any other thing that's built, there's always engineering studies that say, well, in this particular case, when you mix groundwater and surface water, there's some corrosive issues you can have. And so you need to do A, B, C, and D to minimize that. And the city did. I think the city did everything that they needed to do. But I think where the gap is in 2005, 6, when people started having problems and they started contacting the city, instead of saying we need to circle back and revisit the water purification process that we were working on, maybe we need to add four or five other things. They didn't. I think instead what they did is they ignored the issue and in some cases just gave people bottled water and said, this should solve your problem. Well, I think we fast forward to 2016 and we find that that was probably the wrong choice to make because the water then continued to go into the people's systems and what we're having, the issues that we're having now, a lot of corroded pipes and a lot of water quality issues in Northeast Fresno, and now that study is expanding into Northwest Fresno because there's similar issues. So this is a big and growing issue. It's not going to be resolved in the next few months.
So looking at this issue, are you satisfied with the response?
Well, I'm more satisfied today than I was just 2 weeks ago because just as we started to engage in this issue, and of course, there's no surprise or no question I'm running for mayor. And I think what people want to know on an ongoing basis is, what is your leadership style? How would you handle a situation? So as from the outside looking into this issue, what I see is when you have people hitting critical mass, especially with the event of social media now, and then they're saying, hey, are you having this problem? Are you? And we're finding out that now that people have been tested based on their request, and you now have over 30 homes that have lead in them, that's an issue. And I think the gap in the city strategy up until now, which is why I have been messaging, you have 15,000 homes in that area. You have 13 schools. You have hundreds of businesses in Northeast Fresno. I don't think the strategy should be is, hey, call us and we'll help you. It should be, hey, we may have an issue. This is a public health and safety issue, because water is something we should be able to guarantee and supply to our people in a clean, safe, reliable manner. So I think the prudent thing would have been to, when they found out about this issue, is notify everybody immediately. Tell them what the issues are, what they could be, and if they want to be tested, be tested. And that's what I have been messaging the last few months, to show people that should be the plan of action. And I'm glad to see now that the city has jumped on board and they are doing exactly what I asked them to do.
Your opponent, Lee Brand, was on this program last week. He called out your comments on this issue as, in his words, political opportunism. And he said Henry was opposed to the water fix, the big, massive $400+ million infrastructure project the city's underway on right now to build another surface water treatment plant, in part to deal with some contamination issues in some wells and in the city. What do you think of his remarks, A, and B, what are your thoughts on that water project?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really don't know what the connection is between the two, to be quite honest with you. One is a major infrastructure project that the city is moving forward on. And part of that includes a surface water treatment plant. And I certainly support the construction of a new surface water treatment plant at Southeast Fresno. And I think it'll be prudent for him and the next mayor to make sure that they look at the engineering report like the last councils did several years back, and make sure that when you're adding corrosive surface and surface water, that rather water's coming from the mountains, that you have proper treatment of that water. So I have no dispute with that. Now, I know the issue that Lee has raised that he has concerns with is, he raised taxes to do that, and I understand that. I think in the end, every city has to be responsible in terms of how it maintains its infrastructure. I think he's mixing the issue. I think the issue for me is this. In my business, you always want to know is, what did you know, when did you know it, and what did you do? And I think the problem Lee's having with this issue is that, in his own words, he has said that prior to becoming a city councilman, he had a home in Northeast Fresno where he had the same problem. And in his words, the city dropped the ball. They did nothing. Okay. So now you fast forward to 2009 when he takes office. He has spent the last 8 years knowing this issue coming in, has done nothing, and didn't act until the last 2 days of budget when this thing started hitting critical mass. In my mind, I think the question for the voters are two things. One is, can you supply me a safe, clean, reliable water supply? And I think we all should be focused on that. But the other side of the coin, if you're looking at it in a mayoral context, is now you're looking at leadership. Is that the kind of leadership you want? Someone who knows about a problem, who does nothing about a problem, and then tries to cry foul and say, well, gosh, the devil made me do it or what? I don't know what he's saying, to tell you the truth. But what I know is, as a candidate, all I can do at this point is message what I would do and what I think the solutions are. Certainly as a mayor, I'd be a lot more proactive in solving this problem.
Fresno County Supervisor and mayoral candidate Henry Perea joins us on Valley Edition today. Moving on to another issue that's in the news, and that's law enforcement. A lot of things are happening locally, nationally on this issue. It came to a head a couple of weeks ago in Fresno with a officer-involved shooting that took the life of a young man, the Dylan Noble case. You've seen the video that was released last week. This is independent video shot by a bystander. What are your thoughts of what the video showed and the officers dispensing two additional shots that ultimately killed Noble?
Well, again, and I think one of the great things about a democracy is that we have the freedom, to speak. We have the freedom now with technology to on a real-time basis, film, and like in this case, events that are happening. I've been in contact and discussions with Sheriff Mims and with Chief Dyer, obviously like everybody else, watching national news of what was happening. And there's no question there's an issue. There's an issue in our country where now people are saying we need to have a broader discussion. We need to express ourselves through peaceful protests. And obviously I support that 100%. There is a video out locally in Fresno about the very tragic shooting of a young man in Fresno County. And anytime anybody dies, it's a tragedy for all of us. And I feel and send my condolences to the family. I think at this point, what I do is I let the process work itself through. I mean, I know Chief Dyer is investigating. I know the district attorney will be involved. Chief Dyer has called in the FBI to oversee what they're doing. I mean, I think those are the prudent things to do. I think what people want, they want to see justice. They want reviews to be swift, and they want decisions made. And I think the best thing we should do right now is wait for the outcomes of those decisions. The only, I think, as an elected leader, what we have to do is show calm. I think we have to show confidence in the process until it shows otherwise. But I think right now I have complete confidence that we're going to have a complete and thorough and objective review, and then we'll wait for those results to come. But like I've told the chief and the sheriff, and we are all cognizant of it, in the age of technology, you need to do your investigations quicker, not cut any corners, but do them quickly and release that video to the public as soon as you possibly can. And they will. But I think the current city policy that talks about a policy that that waits until the investigation is done, I think is prudent. But I also think the exceptions within that policy are that if the chief sees circumstances where it makes sense to release video sooner, he will. And I think in one part he has. You know, he has released it at least this point to the family. He has showed it to the attorneys, and I think that's a smart thing to do. So, tough issue, very sad, but I think at the end of the day, it's about dialogue. It's about reopening that discussion with every segment of our community to make sure that we build that trust, because if we lose the public trust, then you have Dallas, and that is the absolute worst place that we as a nation can be, because then what follows that are things that we don't even want to think about. So I think we need to open the discussion as wide as we possibly can, get people in, not be afraid of having the discussion and hearing things you may not want to hear. But in the end, we have to be one people and work together.
There was a large protest this past weekend in Fresno down Shaw Avenue that shut down the street. Chief Dyer has said that he is considering charges against the organizers of that as unlawful assembly. The protesters apparently had told him that they were going to stay on the sidewalk. They went out into the street. He says that's a safety hazard. Do you think that's a productive approach to dealing with something like this? This is happening nationwide, protests, not just about local issues, but this national problem of law enforcement violence, some would say abuses of a force. Do you think that's a positive approach for the chief to take?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask that question, because the chief and I had a discussion about this morning. Because when I woke up this morning and saw the article in the newspaper, you know, I thought, wow, okay, let me understand what's the logic behind that. What I didn't know is that in previous protests, you know, that is a strategy that the police department has taken in citing and holding people accountable. And on the one hand, I'm very strong on holding people accountable on both sides of a ledger. And so my understanding is that if he did have an agreement that people would stay on sidewalks and they didn't, and of course they didn't, and the streets were shut down, does he have that option to do so? Yes, he does. I mean, is he in the end going to do that? I don't know. I mean, that's a call he's going to have to make. But when I look back at this weekend, I think for the vast majority of protesters and the police, CHP, Fresno PD, Fresno, so I think they handled it magnificently. I mean, people are angry. People are concerned. People wanted to protest. People wanted their voices heard, and they were. And it was done, for the most part, peacefully. I mean, I know there were protesters on the other side of the equation that were, you know, screaming some pretty horrible, nasty things to the people that are protesting. But I guess in a democracy, you know, First Amendment rights have to be preserved. I think those people need to sit down long and hard and think about what they said, because I don't know if that's been or if that's the right thing to do either. But I hope the chief does, you know, go through everything and make the right decisions. But I think up to this point, they handled it well. And I would just say leave it there. And let's open the dialogue with the community. I think that's more important right now.
How would you use your pulpit as mayor to do that?
Well, I mean, I think I have a pretty strong record of showing that I'll come out on issues that may not necessarily be comfortable for people. And I think as a mayor, I would be out there at the front of a community discussion, starting these dialogues, because I think that's what people want from a mayor. They want to know okay, how do you see the situation? What's your vision, and how are you going to unite a community? And I think that's an absolute responsible role of a mayor to be engaged in, and I would be.
For the better part of a decade, one of the big political footballs at City Hall was this idea of a police auditor. What should we have one? If we do have one, what sort of authority do we give that person? Fresno has a police auditor right now, but for the most part, that auditor doesn't have much power other than to review the existing internal affairs investigations. They don't have subpoena power. They don't have the power to conduct their own investigations. Do you think it would be beneficial to have a stronger police auditor?
Well, I think it's no question it's time to have the final discussion on the police auditor and what that position should or should not be doing. I mean, I think we've seen reiterations of it over the past few years. I think the question of should you have one or not, I think that horse has left the barn. They have one. So the question is, what is the most effective use of it? And I think that's the discussion come January I want to have at City Hall, because I can tell you right now, and I've messaged pretty strongly at forums, in my mind, having a part-time auditor that lives in another state, that doesn't cut it for me. Okay, how can you possibly be engaged in what's happening in this community if you're part-time and you live somewhere else? So I would change that dynamic immediately. But I think the bigger dynamic is, okay, what is the police auditor? What should the powers be? What really do you want at the end of the day in that review that's not happening now? And we need to have that discussion. So I'm willing to have it. I know I've messaged my position pretty strongly on what I think about the current situation, and that I'd be willing to change it and have the broader discussion.
Do you think that's an effective tool in building public trust? Because that was one of the things that's billed or was billed as a benefit of that program. Do you think that implementing, let's say, the way that you want to see it?
Yeah.
Do you think that's a way to get to build that trust that it seems like in some cases nationally and in this community is lacking?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you go back just a few years and look at the history of why people started talking about a police auditor in the first place, it was because there was this perception that maybe there was a lack of fairness, a lack of trust between the city and the community. Okay, so that's the birth of that concept. So like I said earlier, you know, do we improve and or strengthen and really have the conversation defining what that position does? Absolutely, we do. But I guess I'm going to take it on a broader level. First, let me be very clear. I have confidence in Chief Dyer. And he has indicated that based on his personal life and circumstances, he's near retirement. And he's about 2 years away from that objective. And I'm going to respect and honor that. But having said that, I think the opportunity in this community is the mayor and the next mayor working through a community process of selecting the next police chief. Okay, I think that is much, much bigger than anything else that's surrounding us right now on the whole issue of public safety. So just as we as mayoral candidates have been vetted in every corner of this city at pretty significant forums and asked some pretty tough questions, I would vet my final candidates for police chief in the same manner. I would go to South Fresno, I'd go to North Fresno, East, every corner of this city, and put these candidates before community forums and let them answer the tough questions. And I would be sitting at the back of the room at every one of those forums watching how that interaction occurs. Because I think the opportunity that we have in the selection of the new chief is bringing back, for those who may think there's an issue of trust, well, then be a part of selecting the next chief. And for those who think our chief is doing a great job today, which I'm one of them, that's great. But if they want to support the next chief, then to come out and do that. But I think the bottom line and the point is, this community has a golden opportunity the next 2 years, and we're gonna take full opportunities to make sure that happens. And as a part of that, we're gonna be implementing, I think, the new or the updated models of community-based policing. I mean, I have a very limited law enforcement experience. I was a reserve police officer for 15 years, and I was back in the day. And I think when we had the luxury of a few more officers and a new chief at that time who brought community-based policing to Fresno, and it was very exciting. And we were in the neighborhoods. And our officers now are so understaffed, they're running from call to call to call. It's tough for them to do community-based policing. But I think it's time for the city of Fresno to have that conversation with its community as we move forward with recruiting for the next police chief. We do it together, and we create a community-based policing model that we all agree with, holds hands on. And I think that will, I think in the end, minimize probably the role or the need for a police auditor. I think their role will then be shaped and defined by actions and as we move forward. I think just that's the way it'll work.
One of the other big problems facing the department internally right now is morale. We hear that Chief Dyer had this independent report commissioned on this. It was leaked to the media and said morale is a big problem in the force right now. Certainly things nationally going on with law enforcement and the scrutiny that officers face might play a role in that. But what would you do to try to improve that right now? Because the city's having trouble hiring officers. You go to their Facebook page and the banner right there on the top of the page it says we're hiring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of pieces to it, but I think first it starts at the top, and that's why the position of the mayor is so critical and why when I come into that position, should the voters decide I'm the guy for the job in January, is I'm going to send a very strong message of what the priorities are in this community, you know, what the quality of life is that we want in this community. But I think a lot is going to be a message showing that I'm going to be very supportive of our employees in every department in that city, but my expectation of every employee in the city is going to be when they wake up every morning, they're only going to have one goal when they cross those doors into City Hall, and that's to make the city of Fresno better than the way they left it the night before. I mean, we just have to be so community citizen focused in the services we deliver. In the police department, yes, I know the morale is low. To some degrees, we shouldn't be surprised, and that's why in a mayoral context, when Lee and I talk, he and I both went through the recession together, me as a supervisor, he as a councilman. You know, when he reduces 150 cops, when he cuts 25% of his fire force, he shouldn't be surprised that he's having problems of public safety in the neighborhoods and morale problems in the city. But that is what it is. As a new mayor, I would put more officers into the neighborhoods, not necessarily by adding more money to the budget because there isn't a lot of money. What I would be doing, what I've been messaging in this campaign, is I'd be reassigning existing officers that are not in uniform back in patrol. So, I mean, that's how you do. You create the workforce that was going to be out in the streets in neighborhoods providing service.
But, Henry, how do you do that? I understand that there are a lot of officers that were reassigned to desk jobs before in this recession because those desk job positions, the non-on-the beat officers or even civilians who are working in the department, those positions were cut. You said, well, there's not a lot of money to add to the budget. Well, how do you manage to pull those people off desk duty and still have those desk functions fulfilled? Do you add civilian employees to the police department? How do you pay for that?
Well, sure. Yeah. And that's a great question. And you know, I always tell people, you know, I think in my job, the easiest part of a budget is balancing both sides of the equation, right? If you have $100, you spend $100 and you're good. The hard part of my job are the priorities that you set within that. Okay. That's where the hard work is. And yes, I understand we all went through the recession. You know, and I happened to have been the board chairman at the time the recession started in 2008. And we saw it. We saw it coming. I think the city was a little slower in seeing it coming. So the things we did is we immediately went into, we're going to reduce our workforce through attrition by 1,000 positions. We're going to start bringing in lower retirement tiers into the county. We're going to start reducing service and supply contracts, all responsibly, okay? Then the next question was, pick up the phone, you call the sheriff, the DA, and all our department heads is, what can you tolerate before we start impacting public safety in the case of the sheriff or the DA or public works and what they're doing? That's how you budget. Doesn't mean we didn't have cuts. We did. It doesn't mean that there were some service impacts, but they were minimal because we planned them. The difference at the city is, at least in my opinion, is they just said, we only have X number of dollars cut. So you don't cut 150 police officer positions and not think there's going to be an effect to that in your community. Okay, so on a go-forward basis, I mean, I'd like to say that there's going to be a lot of money in the city and counties and everywhere else, but there's not. We're heading into the next recession now. We all know that. So the messaging I have been given in the campaign is the first thing you do is take a look at your resources right now. Take a look at how they're allocated and make a decision how you can reallocate. And just with my limited law enforcement experience, I have to say, I am patrol-centric. I think that is the heart and backbone of any public safety entity. Okay, so in my message, and I said, we are going to reassign 50 cops that are not in uniform back into uniform, into patrol cars, into neighborhoods. Now, you're right. They all are doing something right now, but I go back to priorities. I'm certainly not going to take a detective out of homicide. or any of those critical divisions. But there are other officers that are doing or performing functions that can either not be performed, because if we say patrol is a priority, it is, or if we need to bring civilians behind it at a much lower pay rate to maybe accomplish the same task, then we will. So those are the things we're looking at. But I have to say, to Chief Dyer's credit, I have been very consistent in that messaging for the past 3 to 4 months in the campaign. And the last time I spoke to Chief Dyer, by August, September, he will be shifting, if not 50, close to 50 officers back into patrol. So I think that's what a leader does. A leader has impact by creating vision and creating policy and being consistent in messaging. And I can tell you, I don't always need the power of the office or the bully pulpit to get my point across. And I think this is a great example, like the water issue. I started messaging what they should be doing, and all of a sudden they're doing it. And that's okay. It's not about, well, who said what when. The point is, do it, because at the end, you're improving public safety and health.
Before we go, you talked about employee relations and trying to build that morale with those who work for the city, including law enforcement. If you look back at the last 7 years, I think most people would say there was somewhat of an adversarial relationship between the administration at City Hall and the FPOA, Jackie Parks, and the Police Officers Association. In 2013, FPOA agreed to make concessions to the city in exchange for an extension of the contract. The city said no. That was a real tense issue back then. How would you approach negotiations and relations, to be more general, relations with the FPOA?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, my professional background is human resources. And within that, probably the assignment I enjoyed the most was labor relations. So I was a negotiator, you know, on the county or side. So you could always say, you could say I was management, and then there was the employees. But I can tell you this, in all the years that I served as a negotiator, and there were good years and there were bad years, I never had problems bringing in contracts. Not that people liked in the end everything, you know, how it ended up. But what I've learned real early on in my life is about relationships. I mean, you and I may not agree on something, but I'm going to respect you. And I'm going to treat you the way you want to be treated. And we're going to find that middle. And that's a proven record that I have in that context. And when I go back into City Hall, that's exactly where I'm going to be. I mean, Jackie knows, just like the fire folks know and everybody else at City Hall. I mean, they know in a perfect world, everybody would like to get what they would like, but that's not going to happen. But we're going to find the middle where we can, as long as we agree that when we come out of that room, we're going to be respectful of each other, because the job that we have to get done is providing service to the public, and that's job number one. And everybody has to be focused on that. If they're not, then they're not going to be at City Hall.
Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea is facing off against Lee Brann on the November ballot for Fresno mayor. He joins us today on Valley Edition. Supervisor Perea, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn how UC researchers are working to make those heirloom tomatoes more common in the supermarkets, and why a little bit of science is part of the picture. That's coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Farmers markets are full of bright colored produce at this time of year. Think sweet stone fruit, tart berries, and tomatoes of every color. People love tasty heirloom tomatoes, but they can be hard to grow and they're expensive. That's why researchers want to create stronger plants to get more of those tomatoes out in front of you. And as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, they're doing this using a new twist on an old technique.
Scott Stoddard is an expert when it comes to tomatoes. He plants rows and rows of the fresh market crop on farms across Merced and Madera counties for the UC Cooperative Extension.
They end up on sandwiches at Subway, also at any of your common hamburger places, In-N-Out, McDonald's, you name it.
Right now, those tomatoes taste fine and yield plenty, but he wishes they were more flavorful and had an even larger crop. So today he's conducting something of an experiment at a farm north of Madera. He and a crew of farm workers are planting 3,500 seedlings about a foot and a half from each other using this machine called a finger planter.
So it grabs the planter and it swings around towards the bottom and opens it up at the bottom and it drops it in there. And then there's also water going into here. Okay, listo?
Yes. All right.
But unlike the rest of the tomato plants grown in this field or any other outdoor field in California, these tiny shoots are grafted. Stoddard's taken disease and insect-resistant plants, cut the top off them, and place the tip of a weaker but tastier-yielding tomato plant into the exposed tissue. The plants live in a greenhouse for a couple months, where they slowly fuse together before they're ready for planting.
Now we've got them in the field, and so now approximately 83 days from now, if all goes according to plan, we will be harvesting out here and see if we can see some yield differences.
Grafting is used for all sorts of trees, but is used less for plants like tomatoes for large-scale outdoor production. The process is a workaround for temperamental soil and pests like little worms called nematodes. The growing technique has proven successful for tomatoes grown in hothouses, but Stoddard wants to see how the grafted plants will do out in the open, planted in the valley's nutrient-rich soil.
The hypothesis here is that rootstocks will provide an economic yield increase of these varieties over an ungrafted plant. That's what we're testing to see whether that's true.
He's fairly certain the crop will take off, but he needs to make sure grafting will pan out economically before he recommends the practice to the growers he advises. Since grafted plants are more expensive than regular seedlings, he says he will need to see at least a 30% increase in yield.
They're very price sensitive. This is why it's experimental. So we do this on small basis and see if there's something potentially there that maybe then the growers might end up taking and moving on with.
About 150 miles north of this farm near Madera, Margaret Lloyd, a farm advisor for Yolo, Solano, and Sacramento counties, is also grafting tomato plants. But she's grafting heirloom varieties onto soil-resistant plants at UC Davis. Lloyd says heirloom tomatoes have a harder time fighting off disease and can easily bruise or break open.
We're kind of working at this level of finding non-chemical management tools that will help overcome these challenges so that they can continue to grow these nice heirloom varieties.
She's planted a quarter-acre field of the most common heirloom types, Brandywine, Cherokee Purple, and Marvel Stripe, as well as a yellow Sun Gold cherry tomato and a salad variety called Charger.
We're trying to understand some of the initial questions about whether these heirloom varieties that we're interested in can be grafted and how these combinations might perform under our environmental conditions.
Just like Stoddard, Lloyd is collecting data from the trial to see if grafting makes sense for the growers she represents. If both projects are successful, Lloyd and Stoddard agree that consumers could in time have a tastier, larger assortment of tomatoes for purchase in stores and at farmers markets. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. Black Lives Matter protesters brought a big section of central Fresno to a standstill this weekend with a march down Blackstone and Shaw Avenue. Hundreds flooded the streets to demand an end to what they consider to be excessive use of force by local police. Yesterday afternoon, Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke to one of the protest's organizers, Justice Medina, who says shutting down traffic was the point of the protest and that he won't hesitate to do it again.
So do you have an official title, or what do you call it, community activist, organizer?
Community activist, bro.
Black Lives activist? Black Lives Matter?
I'm from my community. I support Black Lives Matter 100%, but I'm out here for my community currently right now.
In the capacity I wanted to talk to you about, though, as far as the protest this weekend, you consider that pretty successful. Had a lot of people out there.
It was very successful.
What made you want to start getting involved with organizing?
I'm angry. I think I'm angry. I need a positive outlet for me to put out all this energy that I am feeling, and I need to bring my community together, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Was there a triggering event where you decided it's time to get off the couch and get involved?
There's too many lives that have been lost, and you know, the first time I've seen videos of people being killed out here by police, but Dylan Noble really struck a nerve in me, and then we had Falon Castro. And then we had other murders that happened, and so I'm upset, and I want to do something against it.
And do you think the demonstrations like on Saturday and today and potentially on Wednesday, are they going to affect that kind of change?
It's going to help us bring numbers out here and raise awareness in our community. And hopefully we keep a momentum up and more people come out to these protests, because we have to bring the fight to City Hall, to the police department. And our voices have to be heard at point blank. And they're going to be heard. And so on Wednesday, we'll be protesting at 6 p.m. at the Fresno County Jail. And then we'll be marching to the Fresno police headquarters. We'll be right there until they communicate with us. We're not here to destroy our community. We're not here to riot. We're not here to start a race war. We're not here to put a war against the police. We're here to get answers. We're here to make a change. We're here to open up the conversation between the people that are in these buildings and the community out here. Because where's the conversation at? It's nowhere to be found.
You're a pretty young guy. How old are you?
I'm 19. I'll be 20 tomorrow.
Did you ever think you'd be at the head of something taking off like this?
To be real with you, bro, like, it started off with just, we're going to do a protest, and now I'm here. And it's a responsibility that I'm taking on, and I have to do this city justice. I don't know, no pun intended, but, you know, I have to do something right here. I can't just sit back any longer.
And so what is it exactly that you would like to see change with the city police?
I believe, as so far, you know, like I said, I've only been an activist for 3 days. But when we got taken back to Sean Blackstone by the police on the buses, none of them were wearing cameras. I'd like to see a lot of more community integration and events here, you know, to put a face to the names. I mean, we see a badge, that's all we see. We don't know the person behind the badge. I think the community needs to know who's out here serving and protecting them. Also, you know, on the west side, I like to see a lot more integration with just, you know, the police and the community. That's all we need. I think once we have that partnership and we link like that, the violence will stop.
Do you think they're treating the communities they cover like outsiders? Am I understanding
that
right?
Yeah. We did a night walk yesterday, actually, with St. Rest Baptist Church. And it was a group of, you know, white civilians that were walking through the neighborhoods. And on both sides, you saw tension. I'm sitting here just watching it. Like, there is segregation that still happens out here in Fresno, California. And we need to be a community. If we don't stand next to each other, who else will? It's not possible for us to make change without each other.
For a lot of people, though, especially on Saturday with blocking traffic like that,
yeah,
they get pretty upset when they see that.
Yeah.
Do you think you're doing damage to your message by events and protests like that?
No.
Why not?
It's, you know, a social disruption. If we don't cause problems like that, who will listen to us? You see movements like this, right? How many people are out here? You have to cause a little bit of a problem to bring people out and, you know, to raise awareness. We had media coverage. Why? Because we shut down Shaw, we shut down Blackstone, we shut down Fashion Fair, we shut down Clovis. And then we took it to the white communities in Clovis. And that's when the issue started coming off. It just brings validity to our arguments that we're stating, you know?
Like if you don't bring the noise, who is going to?
Who's going to? Yeah.
All right, are you Hispanic?
I'm Hispanic and black, so I'm mixed.
All right, I asked that because I work in radio.
Okay.
So if I set you up for the interview, I got to point that out.
Yeah.
So do you think white people listen?
I've met yesterday that the night walk on the west side, there was about 35 older white people that were out. At the protest, there was also white individuals that were out there. And to be honest with you, I don't see race. I don't see color. I think that's something created by the institution to continue to separate us. You know, we're all human beings. We all need to be out here supporting each other at the end of the day. You know, you also see people that protest against Black Lives Matter because they don't understand that since black lives are being taken from us, that the cause needs to start in the black community. And we all have to come together and support the black community and fight what they need. And come together. We're not stating just by saying Black Lives Matter that nobody else matters and nobody else's lives matter when they get killed. No. You've seen out here, Mexican people, Dylan Noble, white male in Clovis, the suburbs. They murdered him. I'm upset, dude. I'm just upset. Like, I'm angry. And I'm ready to bring this change out in Fresno. So we have the protest on Wednesday, 6 p.m., Fresno County Jail. And then we're following up on Thursday at 7 o'clock at the town hall meeting. We need people's opinions. We need people's ideas. We have to hear what the community wants to be changed, what they need. And so that's what I'm trying to do out here.
We're heading up on the second anniversary of the whole Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, in August.
I think that it's
We're going to be out here protesting in August.
And I think it's lasted longer than anybody expected.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think this is going away anytime soon?
It's not going away anytime soon until it's changed. Until we change the institution that continues to oppress us, there won't. Why would we stop? I mean, if we get conversation out here from the police department and they follow up with what they're going to tell us on Wednesday, I have no more need to disrupt this community. I have no need to continue to shut down streets. But if they don't, don't open up the conversation, I'm going to continue to shut down streets. I'm going to continue to shut down roads until they listen to our voices. And we will be heard regardless. It's not going to stop until we see change.
That was Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess speaking with Fresno Black Lives Matter organizer Justice Medina yesterday during a rally outside Fresno City Hall's. Saturday's protest, while inconvenient for many, was largely peaceful, though there are reports from the Fresno Police Department that some individuals threw punches and rocks. Those are unsubstantiated at this point. Fresno police say they will be reviewing traffic cameras to issue citations against protesters that they can identify. This is Valley Edition. Imagine traveling from Morro Rock in the Sierra to Morro Rock on the coast. Now imagine doing that over 100 years ago. It's hard to get a visual image of that, but in fact, you can. And that's the topic of a talk taking place tonight at Fresno's Woodward Park Regional Library. Michael J. Simas joins us today. He is a photo collector extraordinaire of historical imagery of Central California. He has over 40,000 authentic images of the area and more every day, it seems. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
Now, you have a very broad collection talking about a lot of different themes. You brought in some of your postcards for us today and many people on your Facebook page. In fact, you have over 10,000 Facebook followers who tune in or check out your Facebook page to see some of these images. You've written books about it. What made you get into this idea of collecting historical photographs?
I enjoy local history, and one of the best ways to be able to share that history is to show photos of what everything used to look like before it became paved over and modernized as it is today. And as I've collected imagery, I've come to appreciate what used to be in particular places, and I'm able to look at it and look at someplace today and realize that it had a whole different view 100 years ago.
So now, for those who are uninitiated in this particular hobby, these are real photo postcards?
Correct.
Just give us a brief explanation of what these are and why they exist.
Well, back when cameras were first invented, they were heavy. They were bulky. They were 40 to 50 pounds. And people were beginning to travel throughout the United States. They did not have the ability to take a photo of where they were at. So there were traveling photographers, local photographers who had the equipment, who would go out, take photos of streets, banks, schools, churches, events, and then they would sell those to the general public. The general public would buy them, write a little message on the back saying, this is where I live, this is where my school is, and send them back to, you know, the East Coast, outside of California. And so it was a way of being able to communicate visually regarding where they were at the time.
And they're actual photographic prints. These are not the lithographs or...
There are different types of postcards. The ones that I brought for you to look at today, there are real photo postcards. They were more difficult to process. They are highly collectible today, depending on the subject matter. The stack of Clovis cards that I have there, those are hard to find, and I was very happy to find them.
So I imagine they must be relatively rare. Clovis was maybe just 1,000 people at that time, if less. So there must be very few of these in circulation.
Well, yes. I've only seen a few of them. There are a few individuals here in Fresno County that have a rather interesting and diverse Clovis collection. I've had the opportunity to look at it. What it does is it allows me to know what exists so that I'm able to look for it. But you never know where you're going to find it. You really don't.
So let's talk about this talk you're giving tonight. And I should say it's more than a talk. It's a slideshow. And you have two of them that are coming up this evening.
Yes.
And they're not focused on your Clovis collection, although you have some great photos. And I consider myself a local history buff. I have not seen some of these images before, even in the various books that are
out there.
That's
what I like to hear.
So let's talk about these talks you're giving tonight. The first one is Morro Rock to Morro Rock. What is this all about?
I have a substantial collection of photographic images, and I realized that if I was able to put together a slideshow of traveling from Morro Rock at Sequoia National Park to Morro Bay, Morro Rock, I could be able to document what the trip looked like 100 years ago. And so I went through my collection, pulled out particular examples, scanned them, and put together them in a slideshow so that you'd be able to travel through all the communities that existed or still exist today and how the roads used to look if there were roads at the time. And it was surprising to me just how much things have changed. Now we drive down Highway 41. We're at the coast in 2.5 hours. 100 years ago, it was a 2-day trip, and you had to bring your own camping supplies because there was no Motel 6 along the way. So it was really interesting to see how that was.
And that's not even counting the trek up the Sierra to Morro Rock itself.
No. That the road that took you to Morro Rock does not exist today. It is only a hiking path. It was called the Old Mill Road. That was where the original gate was to go into Sequoia National Park. That was bypassed in the 30s when the California Conservation Corps built the existing road from Three Rivers up through Hospital Rock and then the zigzag that takes you up to the top of the hill.
So along that journey, what stood out for you looking at those images? Since this is an auditory medium, I imagine you had to go through the Laguna de Tachi area.
Yes.
Around Lemoore.
Yes.
And the Tulare Lake. What stood out for you, something on that trek?
The one image that really stands out for me was one that was taken in 1890 to 1891 by the Van Buckner family on their trip to the coast. They took a very nice camera with them and documented the trip. And there was a photo of what was called, I'm calling it the Dodge and Cox boat landing, that was in Kettleman City. And it was an adobe, and it was a two-story adobe.
A boat landing in Kettleman City.
Yes. Well, there was a lake there. So there is an image of the wagon parked next to the ruins of the adobe. It was a two-story building, and it's gone. So at one point, there was enough economic activity to justify building such a structure along the lake. That lake does not exist now.
What's your other slideshow about tonight?
It is Women of the San Joaquin Valley. Again, going through my collection, I realized I had documented a lot of occupations where women lived, what they had to deal with, what they had to endure, all within the San Joaquin Valley. Kind of surprising after you put it together in a group, then you realize just how tough it was to keep your kids' clothes clean, to keep your family fed, to wash the dishes yourself. It was quite a project.
And I understand they also had a role even beyond domestic duties, as you're talking about.
A lot of them were employed in packing houses, cutting fruit, laying fruit out to dry, laundromats. I'm sure they were employed in many other areas, but I'm limited by the images that I do have. And so it's I'm always looking for that type of imagery.
Before we go, what do you think when you look at a photo? Are you sometimes puzzled? You know, why did someone decide this was important to be captured? Or what does it tell us about?
There are so many photos I'm going, why did they even take a picture of this? But at times, especially with postcards, they are the only physical documentation of a location or event. Recently, I found an image of the store in Monmouth, which is between Hanford and Fresno. I posted on my Facebook page and immediately got a response from someone who said that was his grandfather.
Wow.
And so those are the types of interaction that I just loved having.
So if people want information about your collection and the event that's taking place at the Woodward Park Library tonight, what can they do? How can they reach you?
Well, you can go to my Facebook page. It's just go to Facebook and type in photos.from.cemas, and it'll take you right to my page. You like the page, and then you'll see what I post. I try to post something every day to keep the interaction going between myself and the fans of the page. It's been very interesting. I've learned a lot more about my collection because there's so many more eyeballs on it. And what I may have as a neat photo of a person, I'll get the entire person's life story from an amateur genealogist who might live on the East Coast. And it just keeps blowing me away when I see that happening.
And people can also get information about your books there as well.
Yes, yes. I'll be hawking my book tonight at the event. Not that that's the main thing. I'll sell them. I'm just more happy to be able to share the imagery that I have.
And what time is that tonight?
It will begin at 7 at the Woodward Park Library. I would advise you to get there early to get a good seat. And I hope it'll be an enjoyable event for everyone.
You can find Michael J. Seamus's photos on Facebook and tonight at the Woodward Park Regional Library. A trip from Morro Rock in the Sierra to Morro Rock on the Central Coast over 100 years ago, and Women of the Valley over 100 years ago. That's the topic tonight. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. talk@kvpr.org is our email. You can tweet us @KVPR and @Valley Edition and find us on Facebook as well. We are Valley Public Radio. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. And stay tuned, a special broadcast of Here and Now coming at 10:20 this morning, a live broadcast of the Interfaith Ceremony, the memorial service honoring those who lost their lives in Dallas last week. President Obama and former President George W. Bush expected to speak. That's coming up later this hour on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.